This is a good time to talk about resilience, following up on our Advent lesson in which we explored our tradition's call to, as well as several tools our tradition gives us to make us able to, be champions of hope. We talked about not being people who can access hope only during times that are going well, but especially when things are tough. Especially when things are discouraging, especially when things are demoralizing and difficult. So it strikes me that it's a good time to talk about resilience. Also, following up on the last few weeks, when we explored how essential authentic community is, how essential spiritual community is, not just as a tool to help us during tough times, but actually the environment in which our souls thrive. Because when we are in spiritual community, authentic spiritual community, as we've said, trusting and supporting, it makes us healthy. It makes us robust. It makes us strong. It makes us resilient. So, living in that environment makes our hearts and makes our minds and makes our souls hale and hearty. It makes us able and strong. Community, when practiced in the ancient wisdom ways, forms a bedrock of strength within us, a bedrock that enables us to navigate painful times and difficult times. But more than just navigate, we're going to see this week and next, helps us thrive in the midst of difficult times, to come out the other side as though we had been to the wilderness, tested and tried and sturdier for the experience. So I thought it an appropriate follow-up for those two lessons to talk a bit about resilience. And I decided today to start by looking at a handful of our ancient texts. It turns out that the accumulated wisdom of those who have gone before us shows up in our texts pretty regularly on the topic of resilience. Because, it turns out, we are not the first generation of people to experience pain. We are not the first generation of people to experience trouble. Not the first generation to need resilience during hard times. Our scriptures are full of accounts of people who went through very painful, troubling, difficult times, severe times of trouble, troubles that would either destroy them or strengthen them. There are several ancient stories that I could have selected for this lesson on resilience. I decided to start with Paul. I chose Paul and a letter that he wrote to a first century spiritual community in the city of Philippi. He wrote that letter in a time of pain. He wrote the letter in a time of trouble. He was facing what he suspected could become a death sentence that was looming over his head. I'll tell you the backstory to the letter in a moment. Here's a paraphrase of a section that he wrote to them. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I know what it is to suffer, and I know what it is to have great joy. I've had it all. And along the way, I've learned to access internal settledness no matter where I am. I've learned to access the internal source of strength to make it through anything. Now, I don't mean to say I didn't need your help. Quite the contrary. It was deeply encouraging that you stood by me in my time of troubles. With you by my side, I have it all. An unshakable internal resource and a community like you, I can face anything. The backstory is, Paul was in prison. Now, prison then wasn't what prison is today. Prisoners were both incarcerated and had to support themselves. In other words, prison did not feed them or clothe them while they were incarcerated. In fact, sometimes prison didn't even house them. House arrest was a way to deny a prisoner freedom, deny a prisoner a way of making a living, and do so without costing the system the price of warehousing the prisoners. So Paul was imprisoned several times that we know of. At least one of them was under house arrest. And this letter was written during one of those times when he was in prison. Which one of them is not as clear, but we know that it's called one of the prison letters. Now, what is clearer than which time of imprisonment he wrote this letter in is the context. He wrote to this spiritual community in Philippi after they had heard of his plight and after they had sent a man from their community to him with a supply of monies or a supply of food. Whatever they brought, they sent Epaphroditus to Paul in order to bring sustenance to him during this time of imprisonment. That was his name, Epaphroditus, the representative from Philippi. Well, when he arrived, he delivered the collection that the folks in Philippi had gathered for Paul, and then he got sick. He got really sick, like death on the door kind of sick. Now, he eventually recovered, but it was a long journey back to health, and during this lengthy recuperation, he and Paul became very close to one another. They became very close personally with one another, but also as Epaphroditus was telling him about the spiritual community in Philippi, he came to hold both Epaphroditus and that community dearly in his heart. And you can see that in the letter that he wrote to them. This letter that made it into our sacred texts is both a thank you to the community for standing with him and also an expression of his great affection for them. Now, when you get under the layers of the ancient language and the ancient custom, when you get to the story that's underneath the story, the letter is kind of bittersweet. It is written with deep intimacy, and it is written with deep pain. The letter echoes themes of great love and great loss. Paul is struggling. He's going through difficult times, and that shows up in the letter. The tone was affected, I'm sure, by what Paul and Epaphroditus had just gone through together as Epaphroditus had that near-death experience. It was affected, I'm sure, by the looming sentence that Paul was awaiting, potentially a death sentence. There's a very real possibility that this was the time, if this was the second imprisonment in Rome in which he wrote this, scholars can't really tell, but if this was the second imprisonment in Rome, it did exactly turn out to be that. There was a death sentence. He was executed. But it's a letter very much in touch with the pain of human experience. But even so, it wasn't a maudlin letter. In fact, quite the opposite. There's no self-pity in the letter. The focus is not on Paul's unhappiness or even the more general theme of human unhappiness in the face of suffering. For goodness sakes, if you followed Paul's life, there was plenty of reason for him to have unhappiness, but that's not where his mind went as he was speaking to the people at Philippi. In fact, he used the context of his suffering. He used the context of difficulty and the hard times that they had been going through to reflect on something good that had happened to him inside of him, something that had made it possible for him to thrive and to flourish even during difficult times, hard times. And that's something he wanted to give as a gift of affection to the community there. The letter was one of someone who cares deeply, and the letter was one of someone who has deep insights into how life works. The message that he wanted to convey to those that he loved said, sometimes things go well, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes pain, and sometimes pleasure. Sometimes isolation and aloneness, and sometimes affection and community. And in all of those, he said to them, there is an inner source. In all of those, that source is available. And by drawing from it, we can get through anything. In another letter, he said it differently to a different community. He said the same experience this way. He said, sure, we face troubles on every side. But we need not be overrun by distress. Yes, we are perplexed, but we need not surrender to despair. We are grievously persecuted, but we are never forsaken. We are often cast down, but we are never destroyed. So the question for us as recipients of this letter is, where does that kind of inner resource come from? How do we develop our capacity to tap into that same kind of inner development? And can we, like the community to which Paul was writing, can we tap into the tools and can we tap into the practices that will allow us to grow into that capacity to face our struggles with the same kind of resilience and the same kind of strength that Paul could? And the testimony of our tradition is, yes. Yes, we have the same spirit in us that was in Paul and that was in Jesus. And that spirit is an indwelling spirit of strength. It is an indwelling spirit of resilience. The testimony of our tradition is yes. For countless generations, we have said, yes, we can, like the community to which Paul was writing, we can share in this experience in our own lives, in our own community, in our own time. We can face our individual struggles. We can face our collective struggles with that same kind of interior peace and interior capacity, with that same kind of resilience. The tools that are afforded to us, yes, they are just as effective for awakening us to this strength, to this resilience, as it was to them. But they are tools, which means they must be taken in hand. They are tools, which means they must be deployed. They are tools, which means there are things that we must do to grow in that capacity. There are things that must develop in us through a process over time. But yes, the same spirit of the divine, the same spirit of strength is in us that was in Paul and was in Jesus. And yes, the same tools that have been deployed by countless generations before us to help them access the strength of that indwelling divine, they are available to us as well, just as effective when we use them as they were for them. So what are those tools? Integral to Paul's resilience, we saw, even in this short snippet of text, was being part of an authentic spiritual community, supported by and supporting, trusted by and trusting, strengthening and being strengthened. Now, we just finished 3 weeks talking about that in our own lives, in our own context. The habitat in which we flourish is authentic spiritual community. And I said that will be a theme that we return to throughout this year. But today I want to focus on how struggle itself puts us in touch with that deep interior resource, that source of resilience. Another author of one of our texts, James, in his letter, he puts pain and struggle into the context of a developmental journey. In other words, as we are walking through this life, and particularly as we are walking the spiritual journey, there is a process of development and of growth, an integral part of which is struggle and pain and troubles and difficulties. He said it this way: "My friends, when challenges come into your life and tests and troubles, even beset from all sides kind of struggles, it's going to help you if you see these tough times as precious gifts." As we'll see in a moment. Yeah, right, James. "I know that's an odd idea, but think about it this way. Under the pressure of pain and struggle, your true colors show. You see them. You see your weaknesses, you see your frailties, you see your blind spots. That's the gift part. It forces you to dig deeply, to access the indwelling spirit of God. Struggles awaken you to the deeper life you carry within. Struggle matures you, develops you, awakens you." Now, it's a truism that struggle makes us stronger. You might have heard that from Nietzsche. But it goes like this: we will, in our bodies, overburden a muscle. And the pain and the struggle of overburdening breaks down tissue, and then that tissue rebuilds. But the tissue has it within itself the understanding that there might be a future stress or a future overburden, so it builds in extra tissue, and that makes it stronger. That happens in our bodies all the time. There is in our minds and in our emotional capacity a similar mechanism. You could call it an intellectual or emotional muscle that goes through a similar process. There is something about being stressed that causes us to come back afterwards stronger. Again, struggle makes us stronger. That's pretty evident just by living this life of ours. But our ancient texts tell us that there's even more benefit to struggle than that. There's an additional layer of growth that is available to us. And it's this: pain and struggle will highlight for us our weaknesses. Pain and struggle will highlight for us false self strategies that we carry around, strategies that we've even come to believe are the true us. Strategies that started because our unique version of personality has some strength, some things that we are able to do. We latch onto those things, we form an identity around those things, and we work those things as though those things make a composite that I can call me. But we find that that version of me, what we call the false self me, or the homemade self me, or stitched together version of me, is never large enough to contain the reality that is the human being. And so consequently, those stitched together versions of self that help us get power and feel good about ourselves, or help us get security so we feel stable in ourselves, or help us find our sense of worth so that we feel valuable ourselves, all of those things will inevitably break down, and they will inevitably stop working, and at best will exacerbate our pain, but are quite frequently the very cause of our pain. Those things, those versions of self that we call the false self, often cause our great pain. And so when we are in our pain and when we are in our suffering, it is usually an indicator something is afoot. We ought to know what. We ought to know what this thing is that's driving my reaction. Pain and suffering reveal to us what's going on under the surface. That's why we as a community have focused for so long on looking at our negative emotions, afflictive emotions, that's what we have called them. To look at those things, to search them out, to find them, and to allow them to serve as a trigger. When a negative emotion happens, when an afflictive emotion happens, we know what to do. We start a process. It is the trigger of the process of the practice that we call self-awareness and self-disclosure. In the ancient tradition, it was called confession, but confession got wrapped up with so much baggage, we don't use that term. We kind of strip it down to its functioning understanding so that we can then build a practice that is helpful. Negative emotions usually surface when a false version of self, some strategy that we created for those energy centers of power and security and worth, when one of those gets poked, or when the world doesn't conform to that strategy because it's not true enough, it's not big enough. When we keep pressing that strategy and it keeps getting poked along the way, that's when our afflictive emotions come up. And so that's the moment in which we need to do some digging to find out what's the thing going on under the thing. Now, if you're a newcomer, you're going to hear about that process plenty. You will hear us talking about it when we say doing a worksheet. If you go to our website, you can read up under that, under resources. It's a process that we undertake in order to see what usually stays hidden. The motivations and the drivers that we store in our brains that generate habits that keep us kind of circling back to the same kinds of troubles. You might have noticed that your troubles follow a particular pattern. Are you serious? This thing again? And we come back to it again, and we'll come back to it again, and we'll come back to it again. I think one of the great, what's the plural of impetus? Impeti? One of the great impetuses of my spiritual growth was when it finally dawned on me, I was over here in this context, and this thing happened. And I was here in this context, and this thing happened. And I was here in this context, and this thing happened. And I was here in this context, and this thing happened. And none of those people know each other. Either the world is just really screwed up that way, or the one factor that is consistent in all of those places is me. And maybe something I do or don't do, say or don't say, is the precipitating cause behind those things. And when we see that about ourselves, it invites us to say, what's the thing under the thing? What's the driver? That process is precipitated in our pain. That process is brought about by our struggles, our troubled times, our difficult relationships, the things that happen at work, the things that go on when we're driving in the car and we want to cuss someone. What is the motivating force that makes us want to cuss this person? What is the story that we tell ourselves? What's the thing under the thing? Struggle invites that process. And if we yield to that process, it makes us stronger. If we yield to that process, it makes us more aware. It helps us unearth the go-to patterns that we carry around of thought and emotion, reaction, relationship, how we do life, broken strategies that will daily diminish us. So, James says, these things that come up in all of our lives that none of us like, tough times, painful times, pay close attention to them. They are a gift that is afforded us. They're a gift. If you've been around for a while, you've kind of heard that in some form or another. But here's the thing. They are a gift. Thank you very much, James. But they're a gift that our brains prefer to leave unclaimed. Because our brains have got a dogged, stubborn disposition to distract us from these painful kinds of things. Master filters, that's our brains. Now perhaps your brain did some of that filtering for you this week. Perhaps your brain did some of that distracting for you this week, perhaps by telling you a story that children who are shot far away in another state does not affect us as deeply as children who would be shot in our own neighborhood. Our brains do that. We've kind of developed these brains that have this capacity to say that something that happens in another state doesn't affect us nearly as deeply as, pray God, never, certainly if our own children were shot. The same is true of financial calamity. When it happens far away, it doesn't affect us as much as when it happens close by or happens to us. The same is true of opiate addiction. The same is true of injustice or hunger or losing our home or being outcast by a group. These things do not hurt us as badly when they happen in another state or another city or even on the other side of town. It's just the way our brains are wired. We evolved to carry a deeper concern for those things nearby and a lesser concern for things that are far away. And so our brains are doing something to help us avoid deliberately, intentionally, that which is painful, that which would invite us into this process James prescribes for us. When something as debilitatingly painful as school children being shot, when that happens, our brains automatically help us cope, perhaps by telling us that that could never happen to us, even though it could. When we see parents who are heartbroken over their addicted child, our brains automatically help us cope by telling us a story. Maybe they tell us a story of some mistake that that parent made that, pray God, we will never make. Perhaps our brains tell us a story that their life is different from our life in this way or that way or this other way, and so it could never happen to us, even though it could. Our brains are wired not to take James up on his offer. Our brains prefer not to see pain and trial and tribulation as opportunities for self-examination. Our brains are wired not to look at the hard things as opportunities to tap into a deeper life, to extricate ourselves from the false self-life. Our brains are wired to do everything they can to defend the stitched together self, the homemade self, the false self, because our brains prefer to avoid discomfort, often by telling us that bad things won't happen, or that they're not as meaningful as they are, or they're not as painful because they're someone else's struggles, or by telling us a story about God, that because we have done this for God, God will then protect us from that. Our brains prefer to avoid pain and suffering. Our brains prefer not to do the arduous inner work that is necessary to be resilient, not to do the arduous work that is necessary to be holders of hope in the dark times, to be virtuous and noble when things are challenging, even in times of pain and suffering. Our brains are masterful at avoiding pain and suffering. Physical pain and suffering first, but also psychological and emotional pain and suffering. For the first, we create technologies to keep us from having to feel pain. For the second, we tell ourselves stories, stories that help us avoid pain. So thank you, James, but no. We would prefer not to count our struggles and our trials and our troubles as a gift, as an opportunity. We would prefer to avoid them altogether. Thank you very much. So our brains, they tell us a story about pain. Our brains will default to a story about struggle and trouble and setback and disappointment. And at the core of those stories is this story. Pain is bad. At the core of all those stories we tell is this story. Pain is bad. Now here's the thing about stories that we tell ourselves. When we do those worksheets that I mentioned a moment ago, we are self-awareness, self-disclosure worksheets, almost always it becomes crystal clear to us about 3/4 of the way through the process that the stories that we tell ourselves are not always true. They are true-ish. They are true adjacent, but they're not really 100% once and always true truth. They are stories that we tell ourselves. Now, pain is bad. That's one of our one and true truths that isn't as true as we think it is. For years, I've repeated this clever little gem. There just seem to be so many times in which it's relevant. I say all the time, pain is not bad. Pain is just painful. What we do with our pain, that determines good or bad. Pain is not bad. Pain is just painful. What we do with our pain, that's what determines good or bad. So when James tells us to count our pain and suffering as a gift, they are starting awfully early to ring those bells. I've got 5 more minutes. When James tells us to count our pain and our suffering as a gift, he's telling us how to get the resilience that Paul wants for us. When he says to count your pain, to count your tribulations, to count your trials as a gift, he's telling us how to access a contentedness that isn't dependent upon circumstances. So let your pain do, he's telling us, what pain does. Let it help you see the you that you usually don't see, or you usually avoid seeing. Let your pain awaken you to the lesser version of self that is holding you back from the full experience of your truest being. If we were to be using the language of the Bible, we would talk about the difference between walking after the Spirit or walking after the flesh. We use the terms true self and false self. What James is telling us is that who we are under stress reveals a part of who we are. We have got the subsidized version of self, which is things are comfortable enough for our false self strategies to be working for us. Then we've got this other version of ourself under the stress of pain and suffering that says, no, those strategies don't work and it's not working for us. Now, we've got yet a deeper version of ourself that is indwelling Spirit of God version of self. But James is talking about this one. When you hit that middle one, when you hit that version of self that is no longer subsidized by circumstances, and when that strips away all pretense and you get to see the false self that you are living, it is an invitation to find out how to live that yet deeper version of self. Who we are under stress is a big part of who we are. We would so much prefer to think of ourselves as that subsidized self, the us that we get to be when things are going well, the us that we get to be when we haven't lost our job, when we're not in national crisis, when we're not in the midst of a family crisis, that version of self, when we're not hungry, when we're not, have you seen that commercial where they eat a Snicker bar and you know all of a sudden they're human again? When we're not hungry, who are we? Often reveals a part of who we are. And resilience is what happens in us when we undertake the internal training that gets us there. The internal training that looks like authentic community, being an active participant in that. The internal training of allowing pain to do what pain does, to break us down so that we come back stronger, the natural process, but also to reveal to us where our false self strategies have been dominating our days. I read a book when I was young. The book was okay. The title was great. The title was, Don't Waste Your Sorrows. What I took away from that is pain is going to come, always is. Sorrow is going to come, always is. If you can avoid it, do it. Do your best to avoid pain and sorrow. But you won't be able to avoid it all the time. So when it comes, not if, when it comes, don't waste it. Allow it to do what it does. It can be a gift. It can be a gift because it can invite the kind of process I've just described. And if you miss that, but if instead you avoid, you look away, you pretend, or worse, if you sink into despair, you will have wasted that pain. It will have come, and you will not have got from it what you could have gotten from it. You will have wasted your sorrow. Don't do that. Resilience training asks us to let our pain trigger a series of hard questions, questions that we'd prefer to avoid. What weakness is my pain revealing? Or what am I believing to be true that in the end turns out not to be true? I so much appreciated the song that George wrote for this Advent, crushed under the heavy burden of what proved to be untrue. We ask ourselves, where am I using some story to avoid looking at my deeper pain, my fear that I won't be of a sufficient security, or I won't have the power I need to be safe, or I won't be validated and made worth? What am I doing to avoid having to look at those primal fears that shake us all? These are all questions that we ask when we're doing the practice of self-awareness and self-disclosure. They're all questions that we ask, we help one another ask when we're part of a committed community, one to another. But hear this for today. Pain is not bad. Pain is just painful. What we do with our pain, that's what determines good or bad. So, if you get some pain, you might want to do a worksheet. If you get some pain, the motivating drive behind going toward it instead of doing what our brains tend to do of going away for it. The motivating drive is the promise of strength and resilience that happens on the other side. That we can, as Paul said, in the old language he said, I have learned whether I am abased or whether I abound. I have learned to be at peace. That's the reward for the training work necessary for deep resilience. And so, Holy Spirit, may that be our reward, that we may be strong, and that we may be resilient, and that we may be self-aware of the false self-strategies that control us, and we may be free of them, able to tap into the interior Spirit of God that indwells each of us. Be that so. Amen.